So for the Dhamma talk this evening, I'm going to give a talk about the meaning of the word Burschen. Does anyone know what Burschen means? I just read it in the paper the other day. I thought, oh, that's a word that needs to exist. Burschen is the word for the look of bottomless disdain and contempt on the face of a teenage girl when she's being made to pose for a photo, like wearing a really daggy jumper or something like that. And she just is far too cool to be seen in that time and that place, but she's been made to do it by her daggy relatives. That's Burschen, okay? Apparently, right? And one of the things that struck me about that is that Burschen is one of those things which actually Buddhism brought into the world. Okay, so this is one of the unacknowledged contributions of Buddhism to human culture is the introduction of Burschen. And I'm going to tell why in a minute, but For a long time I've been looking at things that Buddhism has given to the world. See, when we think of Buddhism, we think of meditation and kindness and harmlessness and wisdom and those kinds of things. But Buddhism actually brought a lot of other things. For example, all right, here's just some random examples. The first ever weight loss diet, right? Absolutely. When the King Pasenadi in the time of the Buddha was over 8, he got very fat and came to the Buddha and was like huffing and puffing. So the Buddha said, don't eat too much. Cut down. And he got one of his servants to stand behind him whenever he was eating. And whenever he got to a certain amount, he would recite this verse about the virtues of moderation. Yeah. And so he managed to lose weight and said, the Buddha looks after my welfare, my spiritual welfare and my worldly welfare as well. So that's the first ever weight loss diet. And I dare say, the best, right? I don't think anyone's ever actually come up with a better weight loss program, right? Don't eat too much, yeah? Especially relevant after Christmas, probably. So that was one of them. Now, another one of Buddhism's unacknowledged contributions to world culture is abseiling, right? Now, you've never heard that before, have you? No? But in the Buddhist texts, Chaddanta Jataka, one of the most magnificent of the Buddha's stories about his past lives, it tells the story of a hunter who has to go for this journey through the mountains. And it gives all the details of his abseiling techniques and all of the equipment, and it goes and lists everything he put in his backpack and all the kind of ropes and the picks and the hammers and so on. And then it details how he would knock the pinions in and then climb up to the different ledges and go up over the mountain. And even he had like a leather hang glider or parachute that he would glide down from the ledges down to below. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? Yeah? So abseiling techniques, another one of Buddhism's unacknowledged contributions to world culture. And I would like to contend that Burschen is yet another one. And the archetype of the one who introduced Burschen into world culture, I would contend, other historical scholars might differ, but my contention is that it was introduced to world culture by no less than Bhadda Kundalakesa. And so what I'm going to do for this evening is tell you the story of Bhadda Kundalakesa, who was one of the bhikkhunis, one of the arahant nuns in the time of the Buddha. And I'm going to tell you about how she introduced Burschen into the world. So before I start telling this story about Bhadda, I should give a little bit of a disclaimer that while I tell this story, I will be making stuff up, okay? So don't go away from this and say, Bhattacharya said X, Y, Z, therefore it must be true, and he's a Pali scholar and he's written all these books and blah, blah, blah. No, I'm making things up. Actually, I did write a book about this. I wrote a novel because I really liked her story so much, but it's been told in all these different places. So I wrote a little novel about it called Dreams of Bhadda. So this is an ad for my book. Go out and Google it, Dreams of Bhadda. It's very cool. Okay, so Dreams of Bhadda. And one of the interesting things about her story, which I was originally approached it because I was researching the history of the bhikkhunis and the nuns in the time of the Buddha. And what we find is that in the earliest scriptures, we have the voice of Bhadda herself. Right? So a few verses only three or four verses found in the ancient collection, the Terigata. So there's just these few scraps, yeah? But even in those few scraps, you find this very strong and very confident voice that she speaks of. And it's quite distinctive. One of the reasons why her verses were quite interesting was because she says she was ordained when the Buddha said to her, Ehi Bhadda, Kam Bhadda, and that was her ordination. And so this is the only case you find in the early canon where one of the nuns was ordained in such a simple manner without doing any of the ordination technique or anything like that. The Buddha just says, Kam Bhadda, and that was my full ordination. And it was in the hills of Rajagaha. And so it just gives a few other details about her life. And it says, for example, that she, for I think 20 years or 25 years, she wandered across all of the countries of India. And she lists the countries, Champa and Magadha and Kosala and so on. And she wandered across all of those countries. And that's quite an amazing thing, you know, for a female ascetic in those days, yeah? Just to walk from all across India, wandering from town to town, going for alms in the towns and so on. So this, even though we only get a few words from Bhadda, we already get this impression of someone who's quite bold, quite adventurous, and quite strong-willed. Many of the details of her life are then supplied in a traditional commentary. And so the story I'm going to be telling you comes from the traditional commentary. But one of the other interesting things I found was that all the different commentarial versions, there's quite a few of them, but they all contradict each other. They all tell slightly different stories. It's a similar kind of story, but the details are always different. And so rather than trying to figure out what really happened, which is probably impossible, I like to look at it to try to sort of use it as a story. And because to me there are some very wonderful ideas in that story. It's very entertaining, a very dramatic account. So anyway, so I'm going to be just making stuff up. So, okay, Bhadda was born in Rajagaha, brought up in Rajagaha, which was one of the main cities in the time of the Buddha. And her father, it seems, was probably an administrator or a councillor in the local government. Anyway, had a position of some standing in the community. And the story begins usually with Bhadda at 16 years of age, being locked in a tower, right? So this is probably quite a familiar idea. You know, you get that in lots of fairy tales and so on. Rapunzel locked in her tower and so on. And it's actually quite a realistic depiction of what actually happens in many cultures, because the practice of secluding a girl at that age, yeah, she's just in puberty, and so the practice of putting a girl like that into seclusion for a period of time is actually very widespread, and find it happens in many cultures, and it still does. And I know when speaking to some of my Sri Lankan friends that they've said even in their generation in Sri Lanka that would still happen, that girls would go away for a period of time or be kept secluded for a while at that time. So the meaning of this is like something like a change of life. Like Bhadda at that age, she's changing from being a girl to becoming a woman. Yeah? Her body's changing. She has a first period. All of these things, like the awakening of womanhood. And so that's like taking on a new identity. And I think that fact of that taking on a new identity, being uncomfortable in your skin, not knowing how to sit inside your body, this, I think, is the origin, really, of where Burschen comes from, right? You're kind of too cool for anything, yeah? And it really comes from being not knowing who you are. You used to be one thing, and you're becoming another. And so this being locked up in a tower, so the tower itself is quite significant. So you're not on the ground and you're not in the sky. You're neither one thing nor the other. And that sense of being suspended, of that sense of being in between, is really essential in spiritual practice. And that's one of the reasons I thought to tell this story for this evening, because right now we're in an in-between period. Yeah, we're in the holiday period. One year is finishing, another year is about to start. We know what the old year was, but we don't quite know what the next year is going to be. So this is like a period of suspension. Yeah, all of the normal routines and so on are suspended, right? Normally, you know, you come to Nolamara and you know, the monks give a Dhamma talk and you do some meditation. But now on Monday night, you come and there's got to be a party, right? So this is like chaos. Yeah, so this is what the new year should be. It should be anarchy and chaos, and you throw everything up in the air and you see what comes in the next year. And this is one of the things that you see if you look at accounts of people's spiritual journeys, that there's always this sense of going into this in-between space where all the boundaries and all of the expected routines get left behind. And I think, for example, of the life of the Buddha when he left his home, he travels into the forest. Yes, it's sort of classic, you're in the wilderness. Everything is left behind. You don't have nothing to hold on to. All of the things that you normally choose to identify yourself by are all gone. So this is what's happening to Bhadra. The old has gone. All the things that Bhadra as a girl is gone. And Bhadra as a woman is not yet there. So she doesn't know who she is. So she's kind of suspended in that kind of in-between state. One of the most famous of the Buddhist stories is a story called the Vaisantara Jataka. And in traditional Theravadan countries, Vaisantara Jataka is perhaps the most famous of all the stories, and it tells the story of the Buddha's past life, his immediate past life before he became awakened. And one of the interesting things about the Vaisantara Jataka is, what is the meaning of the word Vaisantara? And Vaisantara is not really explained in the commentary to it. It says Vaisantara means that he was born in the Vesa, like in the merchant section of the town. I think that's a very boring explanation. And there's another places where Vaisantara is used as an epithet of the Buddha, right? So the Buddha's described as Vaisantara. I don't think it means that he was born in the merchant section of the town. But what Vaisantara literally means is in between all, in between everything. Yeah? Vesa means all. Antara means in between. So this is that state of that bodhisattva before he reaches awakening. He's in between everything. Everything is left behind, but then what is new is not yet realized. So that state of suspension. And I think that's something just important to reflect about in this kind of period, in the holiday period, just to take that time to just say, well, I can leave everything behind. I don't have to worry about, you know, career and promotion and jobs and getting things done and all of those things. You can just have a period where everything can just go and see what emerges out of it. And the more deeply that you can do that, if you can let go of a few things, that's good. If you can let go of a lot, that's better. If you can let go of everything, yeah, like the Bodhisattva did, Vaisantara, in between everything. The deeper you let go, then the deeper the insights that will come about what is to come next. So here's Bhadra. Now it seems very cruel. Here she is locked up in her tower, right? And we're thinking, times that way, people were so barbaric, and how could they do that, and what a terrible thing to do to that poor young girl. But that's pretty much what all the parents in here have done at one time or another, haven't they? Yeah? You have to lock up your children from time to time, put restrictions on them, yeah? Be home by such and such a time at night. Where are you going? Who are you going to be hanging out with, right? So, and you have to be kind of careful about these things because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know, you know, who she's going to be with, you know, you don't know what she's going to get up to, and most terrible and frightening of all, you don't know what boys she's going to meet, right? So this is one of the things. She's being protected. And parents think that they know best. And no matter what you do, no matter how much you think you can lock somebody up, even in a tower with locked doors and shuttered windows so that she can't see anybody or anything, still, you're doomed to failure. No matter what you think you can do. Actually, it's also a little bit like the story of the Buddha, isn't it? When the Buddha was kind of his father tried to protect him from the world, yeah? Didn't keep him literally locked up, but tried to shelter him from the world. So everyone's trying to keep Buddha locked up and keep her protected. But they didn't reckon for her, well, curiosity, stubbornness. Anyway, one day she's up in her room and she hears a noise outside on the street, the main street in Rajagaha, coming from the distance. There's like a crowd yelling and people like screaming sound. And is it like, it's almost like a festival or something, but no, it's not like a festival, it sounds different. And then there's this cracking noise every so often, this crack. And then sort of sound, and she doesn't know what's going on. Yeah, it's getting closer and closer and the sound's getting louder and louder. And she so wants to look out of the window, but she can't. It's all shutted up and locked. Yeah. Until finally she thinks, right, I just can't stand it anymore. She gets a knife or something and levers the window open, looks out down into the street. And the street's filled with people, crowds, like a mad crowd of people, screaming, throwing rocks. And what's the center of it is one man. He's a condemned criminal. He's a murderer. His name is Satuka. And he's been arrested for his terrible crimes, dragged through the streets in chains, stripped naked, being whipped. They were throwing mud at him, clods of earth, bricks at him. And yet somehow, while he's in the middle of that and he's being degraded and humiliated by everybody, and somehow he still has some sense of pride to him. He still stands tall. And he still stands out from everybody in the crowd. And as soon as she saw him, Buddha was, she was gone. She was in love. This was the only man for her. They were meant to be. And Satuka was dragged to the street. She watched him as long as he was dragged off and he was thrown into jail. And they were waiting each month for the full moon. They would drag the condemned criminals to the cliff at Rajagaha, what they call the Bandit's Cliff, and they would throw them off as an offering to the goddess of the cliff. So he was thrown in jail to wait for the full moon. But Buddha knew that she had to have him. This was to be her husband. So she lies down on the floor and she refuses to move. Parents come in. Buddha, what are you doing? I must have him, she says. Who? What are you talking about? She said, Satuka. She said, but Satuka, he's a murderer. He's a rapist. He's done so many terrible things. She says, I don't care. He must be mine. And that is when she looks totally Bershon. Dad says, but Buddha, I've got another man for you. I know somebody who he's an accountant in the king's court, and he's got a son, and the son, he's very solid, very reliable. And I'm sure he's got a good career ahead of him in the accounts department. And I think that'll be really... And she's even more Bershon, right? She reaches the acme of Bershon. It's never been equaled. Every teenage girl who's tried to look Bershon after that has only ever... Just never actually reached that height. They're still trying to equal the perfection of Bershon, which Buddha reached at that point. And she just lay there, and she wouldn't get up, and she wouldn't move, and no matter what they said or what they did, she lay there 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, not eating, not drinking, 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. She said, I'm going to lie here until I have Satuka as my husband or I'll die. So this is also, I think, quite an interesting thing. I mean, if you know, it sounds like very extreme behavior. Maybe it doesn't, maybe to those parents of teenage girls, it doesn't sound like such extreme behavior. But it sounds a little bit extreme. But you know, if you think today about, you know, say eating disorders, for example, yeah, and how, you know, obviously is very characteristic of teenage girls, and obviously in a sense is related to these body image problems and this whole thing of changing from girl to being a woman and unable to accept or to deny who you are, and you're and is very uncomfortable with your own skin. And so she's just lying there day after day not eating and quite prepared to die. And her parents know her. They know how stubborn she is. And they know that she's just going to do it. So what are they going to do? They have two choices. They can either let their daughter die, or they can marry her to the criminal. Now, you know, if you've I'm sure the parents in the room have always, you know, had the experience of when their daughters come back with the first boyfriend or something like that, and you're always kind of a bit suspicious about him, you know. Is he good enough? Is he going to be... But none of you have ever had your daughter bring back a boyfriend as bad as that, right? Maybe he was a bikie or something like that, but nowhere near as bad as Satuka. So what are you going to do? So eventually they just gave in. They couldn't stand. She was just far stronger than they were. The father was the friends of the magistrate. He went to the magistrate and talked to him about it. The magistrate, of course, was shocked, but he said, what can I do? My daughter's going to die. He said, is there any way you can free Satuka so he can marry my daughter? And the magistrate said, well, there are ways. We can find somebody else. You know, the people must have blood, right? There's been death. Yeah? But... well, we can find somebody else, someone, you know, somebody who no one will miss. Yeah? And we can throw him off the cliff instead. So he says, do it. So that's what they did. And they bring Satuka out. They clean him up. Give him fresh clothes. And they had him married to Bhadda. You can imagine what it would have been like sitting around the dinner table that evening. Very awkward. Could you just pass the chapatis, please? So, they brought Satuka in the family. And Satuka had a story, you know. There's always two sides to these things. He said, I didn't do all those things they accused me of. He said, actually, it's the king is jealous of me because I was in my home village, I was very popular. People started to gather around me and they respected me more than they respected the king, and that's why the king made up all these lies. Yeah? So they didn't quite know what to think. Is it the case he was just a warrior? Maybe he was a great chief. He'd been misrepresented, yeah? He'd been maligned by the king. But still, you know, having a condemned murderer in your home was not really the best thing for the family, yeah? Their friends found new excuses not to come around and visit. Neighbors looked askance at them when they came out. And so the family sort of withdrew, became kind of diminished. But Bhadda was very happy for a while. And they lived together for a year. At the end of the year, Satuka changed somehow. He became withdrawn. He wouldn't talk. In the house there, they had a cage with two parrots in it. And in different versions of this story, the parrots figure in different ways. It's quite an interesting little motif. But in one of the versions, Satika kind of looks at them and looks at these two parrots in the cage and thinks, oh, they're locked up and they can't go anywhere. What would happen if they were freed? So one day he says to Bhadda, he says, Bhadda, my dear, it's now 1 year since I've been released. I made a prayer at that time to the goddess of the robber's cliff, and I said to the goddess that I would make her an offering every year if she could free me. So we must go to robber's cliff and make an offering. And so Bhadda says, okay, well, since it's our anniversary, we'll get dressed up. She put on her nice jewels and a nice dress, and they took an offering of fruits and flowers, and they climbed up to the top of the robber's cliff. I don't know if any of you have been to Rajagaha. It's one of the great holy sites of Buddhism, modern-day Rajgir. And Rajagaha is like a city in the middle surrounded by a ring of hills. And I'm not sure whether they've been able to identify which one of the hills was the robber's cliff. I suppose you'd be able to tell it from all the bones at the bottom. But anyway, there's certainly quite a few cliffs around there. So they climbed up the top of the cliff and they're kind of looking out over the cliff. And Bhadda's like, wow, so beautiful. Look at the view. It's so wonderful. And then Satika says, okay, that's it. And she says, what do you mean? He says, that's it, I'm finished. What do you mean we're finished? He said, give me your jewels. She said, what are you talking about? You know, we're married. These jewels belong to you. He said, just give them to me. She said, I don't understand. How could you be so cruel? What are you saying to me? He's saying, it's over. I'm going to kill you. Yeah. Of course, she's completely horrified. What? Well, how can you do this? We've been so happy together. And Satika said, well, maybe it's in your nature to be happy, Bhadda, but it's not in mine. It's my nature to kill. I've been trapped. You've kept me trapped in the house for a year. Now it's my time to be free. And so Bhadda said to him, she said to him, Satika, this will not be the first time that a faithful wife has been murdered by her husband. And even though you're going to kill me and I've done nothing wrong, still for this last year you've been a good husband to me. And so before I die, allow me to pay respects to you one last time. Allow me to honor you as a wife should honor her husband. And Satika was a very proud man. So he said, okay, that's suitable. You should honor me before I kill you. So Satika did what they call the dakina, walking, put her hands in Anjali and circumambulating three times, yeah, like we circumambulate the Buddha. So she walked around him once, she walked around him twice, and as she walked around the third time, walking behind him, she pushed him over the cliff. So that's how she got free. That's how she honored her husband. She pushed him over the cliff. Now that detail, it's hard to know whether that detail is authentic or not, but it really matches with the stories of Bhadda later on. And one of the interesting things is that story of the girl who marries a criminal or marries a man and then later kills him is a very widespread folktale. It's one of these folktales you find right across the world. And many of the early Buddhist Jataka stories and so on will tell a similar tale. And even in Western stories you find a similar thing. There's a Scottish folk song called May Colvin, which actually is almost exactly the same. And May Colvin pushes her husband over the cliff. So what's she going to do then, right? She's completely ruined her life already. She's only 17 now. Everything's finished. Yeah, she's done, gone out on such a limb with her family, forced them to do this completely outrageous thing, which proved to be exactly as stupid as everybody thought it would be, right? And he actually was an evil bastard. And she ruined her life and her family's life for the sake of this murderer. So what's she going to do? Go back home and say, oh, Mum and Dad, you were right all along? I shouldn't have looked Bershon at you. Who's going to want to marry her? Right? So we don't know exactly what happened next. But what we do know is that at a certain time she became a Jain nun. Now, at that time, in the time of the Buddha, of course, there were many different orders of monastic orders of different sects, and one of the best known ones apart from Buddhism was the Jains. And the Jains had a nun's order, just like the Buddhists had their bhikkhunis. But the Jain religion is older than Buddhism, and so the Jain monks and nuns were already in existence when the Buddha came along. And this might explain why she originally became a Jain nun. It might have been the case that there was the Buddhist nuns' order wasn't in existence yet, or it might have just been an accident. Sometimes people just happen to, you know, whatever monastery they end up in or whatever. Anyway, so she became a Jain nun and she practiced in that way for a while. Now, if you know anything about Jainism is a religion which emphasizes many of the same things that Buddhism does, harmlessness and compassion and loving kindness and so on. But as well as that, whereas Buddhism tends to emphasize meditation and development of the mind, Jainism tends to emphasize self-torment. Okay, so torturing your body to find release from suffering. And if you've seen the pictures, you've probably seen pictures or something of the Indian sadhus where they're kind of standing on one leg or, you know, fasting for long periods of time and so on and so forth. Some of them, they'll do the practice where you just stand and put your one hand in the air for like months at a time until it becomes withered and so on, even years at a time. But that's like the soft practice. That's for wimps, right? The tough one is when you put both hands in the air, okay? You think about it, right? Both hands in the air all the time. Everything becomes a problem, right? Opening the door becomes a problem, yeah? So these you still kind of find this is quite common in India. Now, one Mankanda Arjun Jayasaro told the story. He was traveling around India, walking from one place to another. And at that time, he was doing what they call sitter's practice. So this is something which the Buddhist monks sometimes do, where they make a determination that they won't lie down to sleep. Okay, so they'll stay up and stay sitting. And so at that time, Arjun Jayasaro was doing this practice. And, you know, wandering from one place to another and not lying down to sleep, it's quite a tough practice, right? So for a Buddhist monk, that's pretty tough. And he went to one village, and they found a place to put him up for the night, and they put him up together with this Indian rishi or sadhu. And Arjun Jayasaro was tired from walking all day, and so he just wanted to sort of lean against the wall and try to get some rest. But there was a bright light. There's like a really bright light in the room, and this sadhu, this Indian monk, this ascetic, was just walking backwards and forwards in the room the whole time with this bright light on. And Arjun Jayasaro was like, oh, when's he going to, you know, get some rest? When am I going to get some, turn the light off? And he had like a swing. So the only things that were in that room was completely bare, and there was just a swing, like two ropes with a piece of wood across it. And every so often, this sadhu would kind of stop from his walking and then just kind of lean on the swing. And after a while, Arjun Jayasaro realized that this sadhu was keeping like only two postures, okay? So walking and standing, right? So he would never sit down, yeah? So Arjun Jayasaro thought that, well, sitting practice, he thought that was pretty tough, but two postures only, walking and standing. So this is the kind of things which the Jains do. So Bahadur joined that. And again, to me, it's very kind of reminiscent of this idea of, because often they will starve themselves for long periods of time and fast for long periods. And it really reminds me of these kind of anorexia and bulimia and these kinds of problems that you find often in girls of that age. And it's like a misidentification. It comes from a misidentification of the problem, that the problem actually is one of the mind. It's one of understanding, and it's one of knowing who you are. But instead of knowing who you are, then instead the body is blamed. And so to try to find escape by torturing your body and escaping from the body. And so this is what Bhadda did for that period of time. But Bhadda was a very remarkably intelligent young woman. And it seems, again, we don't have that much details, but it seems as if she was unsatisfied with what was happening there and she needed more answers. So in other versions of the story, we hear that she spent time as a wandering philosopher. And this is also a very interesting phase in Bhadda's life, that it seems that after leaving the Jains, after leaving a kind of an order where all the questions were answered, she became one who wandered around India demolishing everybody's views. And she became feared throughout all of India by all of the other philosophers and ascetics. She got the practice where she would walk to a town, and they, at the front of the gates of the town, they put a pile of sand, and in the pile of sand she would plant a little branch of a tree. And this was a sign that she was ready to debate. So if you know Indians love to debate, right? Philosophy and, you know, religion and the self and the soul and all of these things. And so she would invite any philosophers or ascetics or anybody who had a view to come there. It was a bit like a kind of, you know, like a blog or a YouTube forum or something like that. Everybody could put their views and argue, but she beat everybody, right? And it became so that she couldn't find anybody to debate anymore. And she couldn't find anybody whose answers would satisfy her. Now, one of the things that's interesting to me about this story is that the story itself doesn't tell you really what she was looking for. But what I imagine that she was looking for was absolution. And she had murdered. Remember, she had murdered her husband. Yeah, she'd killed her. Now you can say, well, that was in self-defense. You could say it was justified, right? But until she understands that, I think she was seeking for a way out. In the Jain religion says that karma, your action, is a physical thing. So that act of killing, no matter what your intention is, right, is still that karma. It's a physical thing. It has to be burnt away by physical austerities. And the difference between Buddhism is that for the Buddha, that karma is your intention. So it's a mental thing. And so I think, as my suspicion is, that Bhadda in a way felt that she was still in that tower. She's still kind of trapped by her past karma. And she's been searching for freedom for all of this time. And she's still never found it. And everything that she finds and everything that she sees is just another form of entrapment. And I still don't think she's found who she is. She's still doing, this is philosophical version, right? She's just going around and being too cool and contemptuous of every idea that everybody has. And this is something that's quite possible to do, right? I mean, the philosophy and spiritual things. If you want to take a very negative and critical and cynical attitude to things, it's very easy to pick holes in philosophies and religions and to find faults and so on. And so if you bring that kind of mind, then it's easy to just dismiss everything. So this was that period as a wandering ascetic. And again, we hear different accounts of how that period ended, but essentially she obviously met the Buddha. And the Buddha, somehow, meeting the Buddha magnetized her. Somehow it brought everything into focus. In the few verses that we have from Bhadda's own voice, we only hear that he taught her the Dhamma. and we don't hear too much details. But then one of the interesting details then is that after she'd heard the Dhamma and become inspired, and the Buddha said to her, "Ehi Bhadda, Kam Bhadda," she then went back to the little place where she was staying in the hills of Rajagaha, and she, before she went into her little hut, she washed her feet. And when she washed her feet, she saw the water from the foot washing water disappearing into the ground. And when she saw that, her mind was freed. She became fully enlightened in that moment. So this is a meditation technique you don't hear a lot about, isn't it? Washing the feet. Yeah. So what's that all about? I think what it's about is that idea again of freedom. Like she was trapped within that karma, still trapped within that tower, but seeing the foot washing water go away, it's impermanent. It disappears. Yeah? And the dust on the feet, when you're walking, if you're walking barefoot in places like Rajagaha, the ground tends to be quite dry and so on, so you get dust on your feet. Yeah? It's rajas. But the same word for the dust on the feet is the same word which the Jains use for the particles of karma. And they conceive of karma as being like these particles which are inside your body, which is what causes you to suffer. And so I think what she's seeing was seeing that dust being washed away, like the cool water washing the dust off, like the karma washing away, understanding that she's able to let go. Even that very powerful karma that she did when she killed her husband, whether you think it's justified or not, but in your mind, it's still a powerful force. So she washes her feet, the dust goes off, she becomes enlightened. If only it was so easy, yeah? Well, it sounds easy, but she had to go through all that other stuff first, right? So actually it wasn't all that easy. So after that, she then spent the rest of her life, obviously as a bhikkhuni, and traveling around India and teaching. And she became very, very powerful and very famous. I think it's possible, I won't go into the details here, but I think it's possible that she was in fact the first Buddhist nun. In the traditional stories, they say that the first Buddhist nun was Mahapajapati, the Buddha's stepmother. But there are, I think, some reasons to doubt that story, and other reasons to think that perhaps Bhadda might have been the first nun. But in any case, she was certainly one of the earliest nuns and one of the most powerful and best known. And even many hundreds of years later, there was actually a book written, and we don't know what the contents of that book is, but it was a book written by the Jains talking about Bhadda, presumably telling something of her life and perhaps what happened to her while she was a Jain and her debates with the Jains and so on. And I think that's pretty cool, actually. You know, even she was so Burshan that even hundreds of years later, people were having to argue with her. There was something about her spirit and her vitality which comes through even after all that time. So this is one of my favorite stories of the early Buddhist monks and nuns, and one of the reasons why to me it was very interesting was because it paints a picture which is so counterintuitive in many ways. You know, if you look in Buddhist ethics, Buddhism always, one of the ethics that Buddhism always encourages is filial piety, that we should respect our parents. Yeah, but the Buddha himself wasn't necessarily a great example of that, was he? Right? He says in the suttas, "Mātāpi tunang rodantānang," though my mother and father wept with tears running down their faces, still I went forth. And Bhadra is another example of this. Yeah? She didn't listen to her parents. From a conventional point of view, right, obviously she should have, right? From a conventional point of view, it was obviously a very, very bad mistake. She had been completely irrational and stupid and suffered greatly because of it, and everybody suffered greatly from it. But on the other hand, she also got enlightened. And maybe if she hadn't been so stubborn and so Burshan, then she wouldn't have got enlightened. So anyway, this is my story for this evening, and this is how I think that the idea of Burshan was first introduced by Buddhism, and how the idea of teenage rebellion is also a Buddhist idea. So I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions. Okay, I'm not sure. Do we have a question box or something at the back? Is that a... Okay, anyone got any questions?
Ajahn, can you just clarify for me? You said karma was a mental thing?
Okay, so according to the Buddha, Jetanaham Bhikkhave Kamang Vadami, the Buddha said it's intentions that I call karma. Now, the word karma literally just means work, okay? It means action. And in ordinary language, it means, well, what you do when you go to work, right? So you'd say, oh, I'm going to go off to work today. I'm going to go off to karma today. It also has a meaning in religious, in the religious environment of a ritual. So when the Buddha was born, of course, in that culture was very, religion was very ritualistic. And for the Brahmanical religion, they would do their rituals, and their rituals they would call their karmas, their acts. But the word karma had already evolved and already developed from that time. But it wasn't clear how it was going to develop or what it meant. So if you're talking about a ritual, you know, it, does it mean the words that you say or the actions that you perform? Or does it mean the state of mind in which you do that ritual? Okay, in a sense, it means all of those things. And even before the time of the Buddha, you find that some of the Brahmanical texts are saying, well, it doesn't really matter if you can't get all the equipment for doing the ritual and you can't find the time to do it properly. If you do it just by faith, then that's good enough. Yeah? So this is kind of distinction between these external acts that we do and then the internal is emerging before the Buddha. But the Buddha was the first Indian teacher to make the distinction really clear and really definitive. So he said that it's what you do, what really matters, is what is your intention. So the same physical act, if it's done with a different intention, will be completely different kind of karma. So of course, karma is expressed through the body and through speech, as well as just being purely mental karma. Okay, so the Buddha said the three ways karma is expressed: body, speech, and mind. But unintentional action is not considered to be karma. So if you walk along the footpath and you happen to squash an ant, then you're not making any bad karma by doing that. Whereas if you think to yourself, that evil, nasty ant, I have to kill it, and then you kill it, then that's making bad karma. Yeah? So that's really the distinction. One important thing about karma, though, is that even though Buddha said it's intention, karma isn't just any old intention, and it's not just any old thought that you happen to have. And this is something that people often misunderstand. They think that if karma is intention, then you must be making karma all the time. And I have all of these scattered thoughts and good thoughts and bad thoughts and so on. So, oh my goodness, what kind of bad karma am I making? But that's not really what karma means, okay? Karma is a choice, and particularly it's an ethical choice, right? So if you go to the supermarket and you think, well, should I have some orange juice or apple juice? And you think, well, I'll have one or the other. Then that's not karma, right? That's making a choice, but it's not ethically, doesn't mean anything. And similarly, just kind of stray thoughts, random feelings and so on. This is not karma. This is just like white noise in the mind. What's karma is when you actually choose to do something. Yeah. So you choose, and if you look in the Buddhist scriptures, it's always about, you know, choosing, making a specific ethical decision or choice to give a gift or to not give a gift, to harm or to help. To be honest or to lie. And so it's in making these choices that we're making karma, not just random thoughts and so on. So does that make sense? Yeah.
อาจารย์ How did Bada die and how old was she when she died? Can I repeat my question?
Sorry, I couldn't understand that. Could you
how old was Bada when she died and how did she die?
Again, sorry, can you, if you could hold the microphone more still and speak more clearly because I can't quite understand what you're saying.
How old was Bada when she died and how did she die?
How old was Bada when she died? I have no idea. She certainly lived to be a mature age, and I think in her verses, I think it says for 20 years or 25 years or something she'd been wandering. So obviously that wasn't, you know, at the end of her life, but obviously she was a mature woman by that stage. So I guess she died in her old age. Yeah. I don't think any of the traditional accounts mention that. Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about Buddhism and self-defense and how that interacts with karma? Self-defense and karma.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, that's one of the ethical questions that's brought up in that story, right? Because Bada acted in a way, and this, you know, why one of the reasons I love this story as well, because it's so many relevant things, isn't it? That whole thing of domestic violence and so on, which is very relevant. And you know, she was not going to be the victim, right? And that's again one of the reasons why I really like her. Now, according to Buddhism, of course, one of the basic Buddhist precepts is that you should never kill, right? And this is something that we would only really start to question or look at in very extreme circumstances. I mean, we're very reluctant to overcome that, but the reality is the world is very messy, right? And so no matter how fundamental any ethical principle is, there will always be edge cases where you are starting to question whether that's going to actually work or not, right? And whether the precept not to kill is one of those cases. For example, one might, even if you let's say you think that it's wrong to kill even in self-defense, all right? Better to let yourself be killed rather than to get the bad karma of killing in self-defense. But what if the person who's killing is killing somebody else, right? And then you have to save somebody else by killing the killer. You might think for yourself, I'm quite happy to die, but are you happy to make that decision for another? Yeah? These, I think, are very difficult questions. Generally speaking, of course, there's no problem with acting in self-defense, and in that case, I think it would have been very reasonable in that case to think she didn't have any other choice. Right, it was a very dangerous situation. Satuka was obviously a very dangerous man. He was equally obviously very powerful and more than capable of throwing her off the cliff. So it was like a very immediate and present danger. In the case where it's kind of more protracted domestic violence and threats and so on, then of course you usually have a choice to be able to ring the police or go to the authorities or find some other intervention before it comes to that. But in that kind of case, it's probably true to say she didn't have any other choice. It was either him or her. From a karmic point of view, you could say, well, she stopped, at least she stopped him from making any more bad karma. Stopped him from making any kind of karma at all. I'm not sure if he died with that kind of intention in his mind. It's probably not a good place to go. But anyway. So, yeah, I think what she did was justified. Yeah. But I also think it's understandable that you would be tormented by that afterwards, yeah, perplexed by it. And remember that her experience of Satuka up to that time had been of a loving husband, as far as we know. Yeah. Okay, Eddie.
Oh, Ajahn Sujato, can I say something about it? Killing karma thing? Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, she killed in defense, okay? There is karma involved, but it's not a heavy karma. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say that's correct. In that kind of case, the Buddha said that there's four kinds of karma. There's black karma, white karma, both black and white karma, and neither black nor white karma. Right? So that, I think, is really important to understand, and it's very different from a Western ethical perspective. You know, before I became a monk, I studied ethics at university, and one of the things that you always find in Western ethics, because it's always based on Aristotelian logic, and this always sort of comes down to this idea of either or, right? At the end of the day, you have to be able to decide it's either right or wrong. And no matter how difficult and ambiguous it is, there's always kind of the assumption that at the end of the day, you should be able to find whether it's right or wrong. Whereas the Buddha just wiped that assumption away. He said, no, there are some cases that are both black and white. Right? And I think this the case of Bhadra and Sataka is exactly one of those cases, both black and white. Killing itself is wrong, but killing in self-defense is justifiable. So it doesn't mean that there's no bad karma from that, but it means that the bad karma is a very small part of the whole thing. How it actually balances out is hard to say. And then, of course, the last kind of karma is the neither black nor white karma, and that's the karma that you make when you're practicing the Eightfold Path. Okay, so this is the karma that leads to enlightenment and leads to the ending of all karma. So again, this is one of the teachings of Buddhism, that you're not trapped by your karma. You're not bound by it. And very often this is something which is very, very badly misrepresented, even, I'm embarrassed to say, by a lot of Buddhist teachers who should really know better. And they this idea of karma is fate. You experience things because somehow you have to. And this is just silly. This is the Jain teaching, actually. It's not the Buddhist teaching at all. Karma is your action. It's your choice. Right? Karma doesn't determine anything. It influences things, but it doesn't determine anything. And through practicing the Dhamma, letting go of your sense of self, letting go of your sense of attachment, you let go of your karma as well. And so all the karmas which you've caused in the past, in some cases you won't experience the result of them at all, or if you do, then you'll experience them in a much milder form.
So the question is, had Bhadra thought that she threw a piece of rock over the cliff instead of throwing her man, who is obviously having an unusual character? In that case, will that thinking make her free out of the guilt?
So if she thinks to herself that was a piece of rock, why would she think that?
Well, she had a choice. Would she get killed or she kill her husband?
Yeah.
So now there's a bit of a sense of guilt that she killed a person.
Yeah.
End of the day. So, had she thought, okay, no, all what I did was I just threw him out. I don't know whether he glided down to a small, beautiful plane or whether he died. I don't know. I'm not worried about it. So I just push the button. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Actually, she isn't necessarily intending to kill. She's just intending to get rid of him. Maybe, maybe he'll survive. That's not her problem.
Yeah. Hey, over here.
Okay. Yep.
We were kind of looking at the 31 planes of existence, according to the kind of traditional scriptures, and there was a kind of footnote that said if you make 10 acts of good karma, then you move up, so to speak, so you move into the next plane. What kind of determines those 10 acts? I don't know if that's a true number or whatever, but
sounds like snakes and ladders or something, doesn't
it? It does a bit. So sort of what determines the karma that makes you kind of move up the ranks, if you will?
Okay, well, I mean, snakes and ladders, incidentally, was actually derived from the Indian cosmology and karma and so on. So it's not a coincidence. But anyway, I would guess that when it's mentioning those 10 acts, what it's talking about is what in Buddhism they call the dasa kusala kama pata, the 10 pathways or 10 ways of good action, of good karma. And that's a very fundamental Buddhist ethical teaching. It's basically similar to the five precepts, but a little bit extended because it also includes the mental aspects as well. So the 10 paths of or 10 ways of right action is not to kill, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct. Then the 4 kinds of right speech. Yeah, so it's not lying, not using abusive speech and rough speech, not using divisive and slanderous speech, and not using meaningless speech. There's the 4 kinds of wrong speech. And then the 3 mental aspects is the abandoning covetousness and hatred and wrong views. So those 10 ways, there's 3 by the body, 4 by the speech, and 3 by the mind. And so those 10 factors are very, very commonly spoke about. The normal teaching in Buddhism for what's good karma is doing those 10 things, and bad karma is doing the opposite, of course. So I would guess that's what it's referring to in that particular thing.
Thanks.
Yeah. So you can find any good Buddhist textbook will give you a more detailed explanation on those. Yeah.
Just one more thing.
Yep.
You know this killing thing, okay, the karma? From what my understanding thing is, it comes back to your intention, you know. The degree of the karma involved, it comes back to your intention. What's your intention, you know? You understand what I mean? What do you think?
Of course, yeah. So in that case, with Bada, you know, she wasn't coming. She didn't want to harm him. She just wanted to stay alive. So that's a very different intention to what his intention was, which was obviously just to murder someone in cold blood. Yeah. Okay. So unless there's any last questions, we should probably be wrapping up. Okay. Are there any announcements? Anything the announcements were before, right? Okay. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.